WBOI Presents In Session is a series where we'll hear from teachers, educators, and experts on all sorts of topics, sharing their lessons in the WBOI studios. As part of our commitment to lifelong learning, In Session gives us an opportunity to partner with those who have something to teach us. During this episode, we'll hear from Anne Livshiz from Purdue Fort Wayne on the topic of history. Thank you for listening. Welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. Since 2016, we've heard about one country's relationship with the United States a great deal in the news, often with headlines involving investigation, collusion, and election interference. The Russia issue has, quote, hung like a cloud over President Trump's administration. A different kind of Russian cloud hung over past administrations throughout the Cold War. In order to better understand some of the problems we face today, it helps to understand the historical origins of our current situation. I'm joined in the studio now by an expert on the topic, Anne Livshiz, Associate Professor of History at Purdue Fort Wayne. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I think we're all pretty familiar with some of the major beats, the end of World War II, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the space race, the fall of the Berlin Wall. Looking at the last little over half a century, what do we need to know about Russia's history as it relates to the U.S. to provide some context?
Well, I think probably a good place to start would be at World War II. We really have to underscore the significance of World War II in the rise of the Soviet Union as a global superpower. We have to remember that the Soviet Union entered the war as an international pariah and ended the war as an acknowledged superpower, not just a superpower in their own propaganda, in their own imagination, but as a recognized superpower. At the same time as the war ends, the wartime alliance between the Soviet Union and the United States, one can make an argument the alliance of convenience, starts to break down since the common enemy, Nazi Germany, had been defeated.
What caused this to change so quickly other than winning the war? We went from the enemy of my enemy is my friend to simply being enemies.
Having an enemy, a common enemy, Nazi Germany, was definitely very helpful. Ultimately, in order for this alliance to work during World War II, an awful lot of differences had to be overlooked. And some of these differences are very interesting. For example, one of the big slogans, of course, of the Allied coalition was that this was a war for democracy. And we might say, well, how did the Soviet Union end up on this side of democracy? Well, the Soviet Union thought that they had a democracy. And so I think part of this is about certain terms like democracy being seen as positives without people looking too closely. What does the United States mean by democracy? What does the Soviet Union mean by democracy? And it's in the aftermath of World War II that's when you really start to look at some of these definitions and the incompatibility, the ideological positions of the United States and the Soviet Union, you know, really starts to come to the forefront. And in particular, kind of with the Soviet Union as a superpower, it begins to view the United States as now the country that is a danger and a threat to the Soviet Union. This hard-won victory in World War II and the status as a superpower potentially threatened by the United States. And so what we see in the aftermath of World War II, as this relationship starts to fall apart, we ultimately see the Soviet Union interested in demonstrating in every way imaginable the superiority of Soviet ideology and the Soviet way of life. And of course, for the United States believes and wanted to demonstrate the superiority of the American way of life. And this confrontation between these two superpowers ends up shaping the second half of the 20th century. So many of the really important events of the second half of the 20th century take place against this particular ideological backdrop. And so the thing to keep in mind, of course, about what eventually becomes known as the Cold War, is that the Cold War was not just a military confrontation. This was an ideological battle, a political, a social, a cultural, and economic. We see so many battlefronts, right? So many arenas for confrontation. And it's important to know that for both superpowers, they felt that they could not kind of walk away from any engagement. If the United States is going to talk about economic buildup, the Soviet Union is going to do the same. And of course, the arms race. I don't mean to mention it last because it's not as important. It's, of course, the most obvious one. Both sides felt that they had to constantly compete. Even though you have the Cold War as the framework for this particular time period, both superpowers behave differently in different arenas. And this is one of the reasons why the relationships for both the United States and the Soviet Union and now Russia vary with different regions, because they have a different memory of the kind of superpower they experienced. Another important thing that we see is different institutions drawn into this particular confrontation. The United United Nations, right? They become another arena where the United States and the Soviet Union have the opportunity to try to win hearts and minds of the rest of the world. Special Cold War institutions like NATO that also become very important here.
This is WBOI Presents In Session. Our guest instructor is Ann Livshas. And this episode is History, Lesson 3. So anytime two countries are at war, even a Cold War, there's going to be propaganda involved. What was the Soviet approach to influence and getting their message out?
Well, we have to differentiate between domestic propaganda and propaganda for an international arena. For the domestic purposes, the Soviet Union had a great advantage, being a closed political and cultural system, which allowed them to completely control, or almost completely control, all information that was accessible to the inhabitants of the Soviet Union. For international purposes, this is where the Soviet propaganda had to be much more savvy. And this is where we already see kind of interesting ways in which the Soviet propaganda machine took advantage of various built-in features of democracy, in particular the free press and the openness. The key thing to keep in mind about Soviet propaganda is that they never made stuff up outright. There was always a kernel of truth. Now, that kernel could be absolutely tiny, right? It could be a big kernel, little kernel, but there was always something that was real that they could then build an ideological framework around. One strategy that they sometimes deployed is that they would buy an ad. Let's say they would buy an ad on the page of the New York Times, an ad that would say that the capitalist world is decaying and that the Soviet Union is doing great. And then they would publish articles saying the New York Times says the capitalist world is decaying and the Soviet Union is doing great. Well, technically, that's true, right? That New York Times did say that on that particular page, right? And so it's an ad, but it's a great example of the way that they tried to use the free press and the capitalist system to their advantage. Another big arena that they could work with was American racism. Again, just because it was the Soviet Union saying it, unfortunately, didn't make it any less true. And of course, a lot of the sources that the Soviets had about the extent and the nature of American racism, segregation, and so on, of course, came from Western sources. It wasn't that it was a top secret that the United States held under lock and key and the Soviets had to spy on. So again, they were using the openness in the system to be able to kind of showcase the negative features of the American system. And the Cold War context becomes particularly important here as both the superpowers are interested in creating allies in parts of the world had recently gone from being colonies to being independent states in Asia and Africa. This message, America is racist, the Soviet Union is not, is a message that's going to play very much in the Soviet Union's favor. And that was something that the United States had to contend with because it was a valid criticism that they couldn't simply dismiss by saying, no, the Soviets are making this up. And so the Soviet Union utilized kind of the willingness of the West to be its own critic in order to advance its particular cause. At the same time, of course, it also wanted to capitalize on the positives of the Soviet system, and this is where it benefited from the fact that whatever claims it made about its own system couldn't be easily disproven because they didn't provide the same kind of access that would allow the United States to effectively debunk so many of the things that the Soviets were saying about themselves.
Thinking about this through the lens of today, using racist tendencies or perhaps xenophobic tendencies in propaganda is something that continued from propaganda of the Soviet Union and outlasted it.
So when the Soviet Union collapsed, I think it's really important to appreciate just how relatively sudden and unexpected it was. It's kind of generally assumed that the Soviet Union was becoming more stable as a system, that it would continue on for a very long time. And so when the Soviet Union collapses and the Cold War ends, it really kind of forces some major changes. We obviously don't have time to get into all the complexities of the collapse, but we do need to note, of course, that there were external kind of Cold War considerations, but also a lot of internal factors that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. And so obviously the triumphalism experienced in the United States about the end of the Cold War and the perceived victory in the Cold War was not experienced in the Soviet Union. For many ordinary citizens, the new freedoms brought a great deal of uncertainty and economic instability, but it was the political and military elites that really found the collapse most painful as it signaled what they saw as this dramatic loss of prestige and power. For Russia, on the international arena. Now, before we feel too badly for these individuals, we should note that many of them found tremendous opportunities for personal enrichment, but they still felt quite keenly this loss of Russia's international standing and perception of Russian power, symbolized by the lament that they are no longer afraid of us. The United States went from being a rival to being a dominant force, unilaterally acting in many areas that previously would have required at least a consideration of the Soviet position.
How has the leadership of Russia handled this situation, the change in dynamic?
Putin is a great example of this. He's on record as saying that he saw the collapse of the Soviet Union as a major geopolitical disaster of the 20th century. Since ascending to power in 2000, a very important part of Putin's vision for the future of Russia, other than the consolidation of power for himself, other than increasing dramatically his own personal wealth, has been restoring, if not Russia's actual greatness, whatever that may mean, then the perception of Russia's greatness, the perception of Russia as a superpower.
There's a reason that during last season of In Session, we did an episode on media literacy. The perception of Russia's greatness is important to Vladimir Putin, whether or not it represents the reality of Russia's situation.
This distinction is very significant as it relates to the strategies that Russia is deploying in order to achieve this goal. And there are a couple of really important, things that we have to note. Part of it is the realization for Russia that they cannot compete with and cannot challenge the United States directly the way that they did during the Soviet era. The other part of it is that ultimately Russia's current ideology, unlike its ideology of the Soviet period, is not really exportable. It's not that they want to make everybody else like Russia. They want everybody to recognize that Russia is unique and special and better than everyone else. One aspect of this, for example, is, presenting Russia as the kind of the remaining savior of Western civilization, saving it from, the feminists, from the homosexual agenda, from, whatever other things that are perceived as destroying the West. Russia is kind of going to be holding the line. And this, incidentally, is one of the things that makes Russia so attractive to a lot of representatives of right-wing ideologies in the Western world, is their ability to present themselves as effectively staving off these dangerous sources. The other important thing to note is that ultimately, I don't believe that the leaders of Russia are interested in allocating the kinds of resources you would need to actually improve the lives of people in Russia, improve per capita, income and so on. Ultimately, they are much more interested in personal enrichment, and they certainly don't want to squander their money on ordinary citizens. And so that's why the fight for perception becomes that much more important. So what do we see instead? And this is where we do see a little bit of a connection, of course, to previous Soviet propaganda efforts, where we see a Russia figuring out how to capitalize on both built-in and acquired features of Western democracies. First and foremost, of course, the openness and commitment to free press that's built into Western democracies, but also kind of the legacy of the Cold War, the negative perception of thinking historically about Red Scares and so on, that it's very passé to think that Russia is plotting against us. Something that, because of that perception, made it that much harder for people to actually, with a straight face, say, but I think Russia is plotting against us, because it seemed like such a Cold War cliche that had been discredited by the way that it was used during the Cold War. And so ultimately, what's radically new about Russia's approach to propaganda for the international market is that rather than trying to spread a specific ideology, in the case of the Soviet Union, the Soviet ideology, the ultimate goal now is to undermine trust in information generally. And this is a very important change, of course.
The idea that things might be bad here, you can't trust us, but you can't trust the West either.
Exactly. And this is very much payback for the perception that the United States and the West destroyed the Soviet Union, that they gloated at the destruction and the collapse of the Soviet Union and the weakening of Russia. And at this point, Russia is not interested in maintaining credibility. They don't care if some of the things that are being said turn out to not to be true, because the point is not to be perceived as this undisputed source of truth. What they're most interested at this point is not to preserve the credibility of the Russian government, but rather to use disinformation as a way to undermine the credibility of media, especially of the internet. And this is such a dangerous thing, of course, because it goes to the heart of some of the kind of foundational principles of Western democracies. It's a very clever way, of course, of using that against democracies themselves.
So what can we do? National security officials have sounded the alarm, and even they can sound helpless or hopeless sometimes. what can be done? How worried should we be that Russian influence reaches another U.S. election?
Russia attempts to influence elections through more traditional means, like funneling money to right-wing political parties in an effort to bring them more into the mainstream. We see that in very dramatic ways in Western Europe, for example. It's particularly interesting since Russia's arrival as a superpower was on the achievement of defeating fascism and Nazism. And so to see Russia today funneling money into essentially fascist political parties as a way to destabilize the West is particularly interesting. We also see Russia funneling money into various organizations in the United States. One of the most interesting discoveries in recent years that Russia has been funneling money into the NRA. While the organization sort of drapes itself in the American flag and patriotism, it is accepting money from a country whose goal it is to destabilize the United States. And of course, as an educator, I do want to emphasize the importance of education and critical thinking. We as individuals cannot simply rely on the government. We cannot rely on institutions to solve our problems. It is very clear that our institutions that we have placed our faith in for so long are really only as strong and independent as individuals that constitute them. And so it's crucial for us to think about, as individuals, what it means to be an American citizen, what our responsibilities are as we think about what kind of a country we want to live in. As a historian, I can't help but add that one of the things that it would be good to do is learn from history. I think the patterns that we're seeing today, the very disturbing patterns that we're seeing today, do have many precedents in past events. And I think it's very important for us to think about what we are learning from history. When we say things like never again, what do we mean by that? You know, when we look back at historical events that fill us with horror and we think, how could anyone have gone through them and done nothing? We really want to think about what our legacy as a society is going to be and how future generations are going to look at us and this phase in American history and what they're going to think of us and our behavior.
Ann Lifshitz, thank you so much for being a part of season 2 of WBOI Presents In Session.
Thank you so much, Ben. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you for listening to WBOI Presents In Session. You can find more episodes of WBOI Presents In Session at WBOI.org. And while you're there, you can find the very latest from the WBOI news team and stay up to date on content we produce year-round. Our theme music is by Noah Campodonico. Our sound effects are by John Dawkins. Our web producer is Loyal Vandenberg. Thank you for listening.